activists demonstrating outside the Glynn County Courthouse in Brunswick, Georgia yesterday as jury selection began in the trial of three white men charged with murdering Ahmaud Arbery. Arbery, who is black, was out jogging when he was chased, confronted, and then shot to death. He was 25 years old. Civil rights attorney Ben Crump represents the Arbery family. He also represented the family of Trayvon Martin, the black teenager killed a decade ago in Florida.
The difference between Trayvon Martin and Ahmaud Arbery is there's video in Ahmaud Arbery, and we expect full justice for Ahmaud Arbery.
Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, told CBS News she has never watched the video of her son's death in its entirety.
And everyone that has watched the video simply says that Ahmaud was not doing anything wrong. Ahmaud was approached. Ahmaud had the choice to either fight. First he ran, and then he had no option but to fight. And unfortunately, Ahmaud was killed in the midst of that fight.
The three men who pursued Arbery have been charged with murder, aggravated assault, and false imprisonment. They have pleaded not guilty to all the charges. We're going to check in on how the first day of jury selection went and what the mood is like in this part of southeastern Georgia. Now, with Margaret Coker, she's editor-in-chief of The Current, and that's an investigative news site based in Savannah. She's been in Brunswick covering the Ahmaud Arbery trial. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so just to get our bearings, Brunswick is on the coast just north of Florida. It's a small, small town, right? Small population. The county is also small.
Yeah, so Brunswick is a majority black town. There's about 18,000 people here. And the surrounding county, Glynn County, is about 65,000 people, and it's majority white.
So the question being, how do you find a fair and impartial jury in this part of the world, because as we've just heard, it's small. What, the population is like 85,000 in Glynn County. So I imagine everyone's formed an opinion on this case. This is a case that has drawn national attention.
Yeah, this is why we are in a really slow, tedious, and deliberative process right now of trying to impanel the jury. In Georgia, unlike Minnesota, for example, where Derek Chauvin was tried and convicted of murdering George Floyd. In Georgia, we have had a stop on all criminal jury trials because of COVID, and that has been in effect for over a year. Jury trials have just started up again earlier this summer. And so this is definitely a reason why this has taken so long to get to the courthouse. But at the same time, because of the delay in both arresting suspects, but then getting to the trial, it has flavored, you know, the opinions throughout the county. So there have been 600 members of the county who have been called up to jury duty this week. And the judge and defense and prosecutors, they're all trying to weed through this large group of people in order to find those who maybe have heard about the case, but haven't formed set opinions about the case. This is the tone of the questions being asked so far. If you know the defendant, you're being dismissed outright. If you have heard about the case, you're not being dismissed yet, because if you're able to hear evidence and form an opinion based on the evidence you hear in court, you are going to be probably selected as a juror.
Well, I wonder how many people actually know one of the three defendants, one of whom was a former Glynn County police detective, the father, Greg McMichael.
That's right. He was, he's former law enforcement. He spent a whole lot of time as an investigator for the DA's office here in Brunswick. And so he has a lot of acquaintances through law enforcement circles, but also legal circles. Here in Glynn County as well, beyond the county police force and the city police force, which are two separate departments, there's also a very large federal law enforcement training center. Most of federal law enforcement come here as trainers. And so there's a large population of people who have that sort of background who might know the McMichaels. However, people who have been called up to be questioned so far in this wide jury pool, they include school teachers, they include nurses, they include contractors, small business owners, retirees. You know, I'm pretty confident that after the next 3 weeks that the judge and the prosecutor in defense are going to be able to find enough people to form a jury. I mean, here's This is a place in a part of Georgia where, even though Georgia has been part of the national conversation, not only about race because of this trial, but because of politics, right? You know, with our senatorial elections last year, there's a lot of people here who don't really follow the news. There's still a significant number of people who never vote. I think there's probably going to be enough people who have heard of what has happened here and still are going to be able to have a fair and unbiased view as jurors.
You mentioned a delay. This has taken a long time. Ahmaud Arbery was killed in February of 2020, and there weren't arrests for more than 2 months, right? And the local prosecutor, she knew the McMichaels. She has lost her job and is now indicted on charges of shielding the defendants in this case. So put this all in context in terms of where we are today.
Yeah, there were 73 days between the time that Ahmaud Arbery was killed and the first arrest to be made. And in those 73 days, the chief of police of the county police department was indicted in a separate policing scandal and was put on administrative leave. The police department itself was leaderless and sort of had this void in it. But in the first 36 hours after Ahmaud Arbery's killing, the DA that is based here, who worked with one of the defendants, she recused herself in the first 24 hours that she knew about the case. A second DA was called in the neighboring judicial circuit. That DA wrote an opinion saying that he didn't think that any criminal behavior had occurred. He had seen the cell phone video that came out in May that we all have seen and formed an opinion about. So the reasons that there weren't arrests right away was that I believe the three suspects who are now standing trial, their point of view was carried the day. Their point of view within law enforcement establishment carried the day. And when that video was leaked and it went viral, that changed a lot of opinions, both here in the county, where there was a lot of pressure growing for arrests to be made, and at the state level, where even the Republican governor said that what he saw in the video was horrific. So there was a widespread view then that something needed to be done. Accountability had to come about.
Right. So a lot of good has happened in terms of racial justice leading up to this, right? What do protesters want now? I assume they want to see a conviction in this case.
Yeah, people who have gathered outside of the courthouse, there's about 50 demonstrators, and they are 99% Black. They are middle-aged and elderly Black women. And a lot of them have come from outside the state in order to show their support for the Arbery family and to advocate for justice in this case. The community itself, you know, there are members of the community who were out all weekend long. You know, again, these are people who have grew up within the Arbery family or around the Arbery family, go to church with them. And people, you know, people do want a conviction, that's for sure. At the same time, there's a lot of worry about what the jury will end up doing, and people retain hope that they have seen a lot of change so far in the last 18 months. Georgia has repealed its citizens' arrest law because of the outrage over Ahmaud Arbery's killing. We now have a hate crimes law in Georgia, which, you know, a lot of people have been fighting for a very long time. There's a new police chief in town, and there's a new DA. So lots of small steps towards lasting change are happening outside of the courtroom. People are worried, though, about what the verdict will say about justice and about their community.
Margaret Coker, editor-in-chief of the investigative news site The Current, reporting on the Ahmaud Arbery case. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Coming up, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin could doom President Biden's effort to curb climate change. Details on that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Ambitious climate change legislation is hanging by a thread. It's part of that $3.5 trillion budget package Democrats are debating. The party's self-imposed deadline to pass it is at the end of this month. And that's when a major United Nations climate change summit takes place in Glasgow. If the United States shows up with no domestic agenda for cutting carbon emissions, it's likely other major polluters, such as China, will not feel an incentive to cut their emissions, perhaps dooming the last hope to curb extreme warming. And the many deadly environmental disasters predicted to come with it. With me to talk about what happens next is Michael Hiltzik. He's an author and columnist who's covering this for the Los Angeles Times. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you back. The fate of the president's climate agenda seems like it's mostly coming down to one person, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. So is it too much to state that he is the sole person standing in the way of this agenda?
Well, he seems to be the sole Democrat who's standing in the way. Of course, the entire Republican caucus on Capitol Hill is also standing in the way. And if they were more cooperative, then Manchin wouldn't matter that much. But Manchin is the one who certainly is opposed to one of the key provisions in this bill that Biden and the Democrats want to pass.
And that's the Clean Electricity Performance Program, right? This would subsidize utilities to use clean energy?
That's correct. The way the Clean Energy Performance Program would work is that utilities that showed an increase of clean energy year by year over a certain amount would get a subsidy. They'd get $150 per megawatt hour of improvement between 2023 and 2030. That would come to a lot of money. That's millions of dollars for some of the big utilities. Utilities that failed to meet that goal would actually have to pay money to the Department of Energy. So you have both the carrot and the stick here. And clearly the goal is to wean utilities off coal and natural gas, which are the carbon polluting fuels that they're still using.
Well, you mentioned coal. Manchin is from West Virginia, the second largest coal producer in the country behind Wyoming. Is that why he's opposed to it?
Clearly, that's the major factor. The coal industry is important to West Virginia, although it's much less important than it used to be. And Manchin himself has a coal brokerage company that he's still getting as much as $500,000 a year from. So he's really conflicted. But he doesn't seem to want to recognize that the coal industry is essentially dead in this country and in his state. Employment has come down sharply. It's simply not a major fuel anymore, but it's still enough to create climate problems.
So what does Manchin want in exchange for his vote? Is there anything that Democrats could do, that the president could do to sweeten the pot to make him say yes to this?
Well, this is the problem we have when we've got sausage being made basically behind closed doors. And the reports that we get of the negotiations are essentially snapshots. And I'm not sure that we have a really good feel for what's going on. But what Manchin has indicated is that he's really concerned about the idea that coal-fueled power plants would be so disadvantaged. And what he's said in the past that he wants is for coal plants that have some sort of anti-pollution equipment in their systems should also be participating in these subsidies. It's possible that that's being talked about. What he keeps saying is that the Clean Energy Performance Program is dead. He can't see any way to approve it. But for all we know, this is a bargaining. This is a negotiation that's going on. We don't really know at this point how it's all going to work out.
Why is this the centerpiece of the legislation? Is this really key in reducing greenhouse gas emissions here in the United States. Are there other ways to get to the goal?
Sure, there are a lot of other ways. This is certainly the largest and biggest key element of this of the reconciliation bill in terms of global warming, because the utility sector is a huge contributor to greenhouse gases in this country. We need to get them off coal, we need to get them off natural gas, and we need the utilities to rely much more on renewable fuels. So that's the process. Now, there's a lot that the Biden administration and Democrats in general can do that doesn't depend on the Clean Energy Performance Program. And there's a lot that Biden has already done and has signaled that he can do. It doesn't require congressional approval at all.
Okay, so what happens in Glasgow in a couple of weeks at the beginning of November if the United States does not show up with a plan?
Well, I think the United States is likely to show up with something. It's not going to go to Glasgow with its hands completely empty and without anything on the agenda. And that's because there is a lot that Biden can do. He's already reassociated the United States with the Paris conference and the Paris goals, which is important. They were basically the U.S. was withdrawn from the Paris arrangement by President Trump. Biden has basically put the kibosh on a lot of other initiatives that Trump tried in terms of removing regulations that were important in terms of clean air and clean water. He's stopped a lot of that process. He's reversing a lot of the steps that Trump took. And all of this these are all things that can be done without congressional approval. Biden has signaled that he's going to be much stricter in terms of enforcing the anti-global warming rules that are on the books of the United States already, and that were basically ignored for 4 years by Trump. So that's a big advance, and I think Biden can come to Glasgow with some of these initiatives in hand. There's also a lot in this reconciliation bill that's devoted to global warming that will pass. Manchin hasn't said he disapproves of, that would probably pass. There's a lot in terms of encouraging a transformation of the transportation sector by electrifying it, moving from internal combustion engines to electric vehicles. There's a lot that's in this bill in terms of home retrofits, $9 billion that would be distributed for homeowners who convert their homes to energy efficient and electric systems, public buildings, the electrical infrastructure. That's all in the bill, and that's not controversial, at least in Manchin's mind. So
right, but as you mentioned, the electricity, it's got to come from somewhere, and there's that holdup in terms of it being produced cleanly or not.
That's right. Though the utility industry has been getting a lot cleaner, this is why we prefer to have electric vehicles rather than internal combustion vehicles, because utility generation of electricity is much cleaner than what we get out of the tailpipes of conventional automobiles and trucks and what have you. So we're getting a lot of improvement. And I think Biden could go to Glasgow and have signs that he could show the other countries for how much progress the United States has made. Now, he's made a big deal out of the Clean Electricity Performance Program. He may not have that, but he'll have a lot of other things to show.
LA Times columnist Michael Hiltzik, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Coming up, the great teacher shortage.
I really think that our entire system and just our entire profession is in a crisis mode because people just don't respect it and appreciate it the way that it used to be.
How schools are scrambling to find teachers, even subs are in high demand. That's next on Press Play.
The
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, beginning this week, all LAUSD staff must have their first COVID shot to enter school property. The deadline for the second shot was extended by a month to November 15th, and that was to prevent a staffing crisis. But anyone with a kid in school has likely noticed that LAUSD is already short-staffed, from teachers to crossing guards to lunchroom attendants. Last month, the district still had roughly 2,000 vacancies. Joining us now to talk about how all this is playing out inside one school is Steve Gebhardt. He's principal of San Pedro High School. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you. And what is the vaccination situation amongst your staff? How many are still unvaccinated?
I'm in a pretty fortunate position. On my specific staff at San Pedro High School, we only have about four people who are not going to be vaccinated for whatever reason. Two specific teachers and then two other non-teaching staff members.
So what happens to them?
So the two teachers have requested an exemption. LAUSD offered exemption, and they've been granted that exemption, as well as one of the non-teaching staff members, a PSW or psychiatric social worker, who is an LCSW level position and provides mental health services. So all three of them have been reassigned to the City of Angels support for students that the district is providing. The fourth staff member is a cafeteria worker, and because there is no alternative provision for a cafeteria worker, because unless you're on site providing meals, there's nothing that you can do, that specific staff member will just be not reporting to work at all.
So fired, in other words.
That's a district level decision, but yeah, it's definitely going down that pathway for that staff member.
When you say the City of Angels, that's the online school platform, right?
Correct. That's the online option that students at the beginning of this year were allowed to opt into if they did not feel comfortable or have some other health reason to return to campus when we reopened campuses in August.
Right. So what does this mean for your school and your students? It is a relatively small number of staff who aren't getting vaccinated for, but still, that's two teachers.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a small number, but we were already, as you indicated in the opening, there is a shortage of substitutes, regardless if we were fully staffed, because, you know, people are still going to be sick, have things come up and need to be out. And every time we've had a teacher out, even at our full staffing, we haven't had enough substitutes to cover the openings or the teacher absences as they existed. So just adding two more to that, even though I am lucky it's a small number, will just put additional strain on that.
Why has it been so difficult to find substitute teachers?
You know, I couldn't answer that specifically other than just what I've been able to observe. And there just is not a real large pool of people who are getting into the profession. You know, many times substitutes are people that want to become teachers or looking to become teachers. And they're subbing while they're on that pathway. But that's been decreasing for years, people interested in joining the profession. And so it's been put under further strain during the pandemic. I think another reason is that the pandemic has forced people to work from home. They've had to provide their own childcare. And so as a result, they're just not available to sub. But I think the larger issue is just that our profession is losing people at a pretty dramatic rate. And something will hopefully change soon. Otherwise, we're going to continue to bear the brunt of it.
Hmm. So, but why is that in a bigger picture? Is it that people just don't want to teach? Is it that the salaries are too low? Is it something else?
You know, the salary issue has been an issue since I've started teaching and then, you know, grown in this position. And so, of course, salaries cannot match what teachers provide to students. But that hasn't created the strain that's being provided now. I really think that our entire system and just our entire profession is in a crisis mode because people just don't respect it and appreciate it the way that it used to be. The continued systemic pressures that are put on the classroom teacher and just all levels of educators on a school site is just something people are not able to manage anymore, where they used to be able to manage it before. But I think that they're finally realizing it's just not worth the systemic pressures.
Hmm. Is there anything you can do as a principal to try to attract more teachers? Any incentives you can offer personally?
Well, I think that people, when they're in a position, what they want to do is find some sort of personal satisfaction as well as find some sort of professional satisfaction. So I can definitely influence that as a site administrator. I can try to make the working conditions as, you know, as welcoming as possible. And I think I do try to do that. But the larger issue as far as attracting teachers are things that I have a little bit less control over because the public perception of what teachers provide is something that has been under attack for decades, I would argue, and it's just something that right now when you add to that the conditions that the pandemic has created, people are just not willing to put up with that.
Right. And I guess the last year and a half was really burdensome for teachers, right? Trying to teach Zoom classes, that's not fun by and large, and it's really challenging.
Yeah, it is really challenging. I mean, the one thing that teachers could count on was at least some degree of separation between their home life and their professional life, and anybody that's working. But what the pandemic did for an entire year was pretty much blend those two. Teachers felt like they were constantly at work because by definition, they were if they are working from home. And so there wasn't as clean of a split. And so the pressures that teachers naturally put on themselves to be the best they can be for their students. I mean, they're serving students and they really care about doing that. And so they felt additional pressure to do that and an additional level of inability to do that because the students were not in front of them. So that pressure just mounts and mounts, whether it is something they recognize or not. And I think teachers and just all educators are really feeling that right now to the point to where it's putting that strain on them that you mentioned.
What are you hearing from parents about all this?
Initially, when the pandemic hit, parents were very understanding and supportive, but parents are reaching the same level of fatigue and or just amnesia about what teachers provide as a lot of other people. And so, you know, there are parents that have just seemed to have forgotten exactly what the conditions in which we're operating are because these conditions have become a new level of normal. And students have been enduring it for the same year and a half that the teachers have. Parents have been able to sort of separate from it since we've started back to school. And so they now imagine school as returning to, you know, the pre-pandemic days. And it's just not like that at all for a variety of reasons.
Meanwhile, students in your high school need to be vaccinated, fully vaccinated by January. And how's that going?
So the student vaccination rates are a little bit tougher to gauge because the only access to that information I have is when the students actually willingly provide it. And then students as well may want to get vaccinated, but they don't have absolute control over that because other than a select number of seniors, they're minors, they need to have a parental consent. And as you just see what's happening out in society at large, you know, schools are just a reflection of that. Not everybody is in agreement that the vaccination is something that they support and want to get. And so that's being reflected in students as well.
And finally, how are you doing as the principal of the school and trying to balance all of these competing interests? You've got your teachers on one hand, you've got the parents on the other hand, you've got your students. Like, how is it for you?
It is definitely a challenge and not one that I could have ever foreseen, but it for sure is a situation that I have not endured in my 8 years as a principal and not one that, to be quite honest with you, if it continues, is the sort of thing that I would want to continue with potentially.
Steve Gebhardt, he's principal at San Pedro High School. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Madeline, for having me and for just representing education as a whole. Thank you.
Well, as Principal Steve Gebhardt mentioned, LAUSD is dealing with a major substitute teacher shortage, and it's not alone. It's happening all over the country. Some districts are offering subs higher pay. Oregon even dropped its requirement for substitutes to have a college degree. Here to talk about this is Mike Tang. He is CEO of Swing Education up in Silicon Valley, and that's a business that pairs substitute teachers with school districts in six states and also Washington, D.C. Welcome to Press Play, Mike.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. All right. We just heard about the sub teacher shortage here in L.A. What does it look like elsewhere in the rest of the country?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing this shortage pretty much everywhere. I think it seems very related or probably adjacent to a lot of what's going on in other industries like the restaurant and hospitality industry. But, you know, I think the pandemic has been really hard on teachers generally and has made the job even tougher than it was previously. And I think very few people were of the opinion that it was an easy job before anyway. And so I think a lot of people are struggling with whether or not that's something that they want to do under current, you know, the current environment. We anecdotally have had some substitute teachers tell us that they still are really interested in being substitute teachers and getting into the classroom, but that they want to wait until students ages 5 to 11 can be vaccinated, or maybe that includes their own kids that, you know, are between 5 and 11 and can't be vaccinated yet.
Yeah.
So I think there's a bunch of reasons for kind of the teacher shortage and substitute teacher shortage but it's all contributing to a pretty tough environment for schools and districts, for
right.
sure.
So why would a district come to you? Don't they have their own pool of substitutes?
Yeah, they do have their own pool of substitutes. Substitute teachers, when they work with us, can work with any of the school districts that are working with us, or charter schools or private schools. And so they tend to get a wider access to jobs. And so I think a lot of substitute teachers like working with SWING for that reason. And we provide some, I like to call it kind of like advocacy for them with the schools and districts too. It can be tough, I think, as a substitute teacher to provide feedback to schools or districts that you're working with. It can be very lonely. And so I think we can help substitute teachers with that. And therefore, you know, sometimes we have a pool of substitute teachers that doesn't overlap with the people that the district has access to.
Well, since it is a seller's market, if you will, how much can a sub earn now?
Yeah, I would say it's gone up a little bit, you know, with SWING in parts of when certain schools in LA, and depending on if it's like a long-term job, there's some things that impact the pay like that. It can be over $200 a day, $220 a day. That might look like as much as $25 to $30 an hour, but sometimes it's, you know, less than that too.
And do they have to have a teaching credential?
It depends on the job or the role that they're being asked to do. We have both paraprofessional roles that don't require a teaching credential or a substitute teacher permit, and other roles and jobs that teachers are being requested for that do require either a teaching credential or a 30-day emergency teaching credential is what a sub permit is called.
So I imagine you do not have enough to meet the demand at this point.
Correct. Yeah, it's very, very difficult. Although, you know, I think our fill rates have been steadily climbing every single week over week since the school year started 2 months ago. And so we're really proud of the work that we're doing on that front. But, you know, I think if you were to ask any of our customers, they would certainly echo that we are not providing the fill rates that they or us would like to see. But I think that that is, you know, a challenge that everyone is facing.
Give me a sense of what kind of conversations you have on the phone with these districts. Like, they call you up and they say what?
They say, when can we start? How many substitute teachers can you give us? How much does it cost? You know, I think people are pretty desperate. So oftentimes it's just about like, what does your contract look like? And they want to get right into it. I think working with us, we try and be an easy company to work with too, in the sense that we only charge what we call for success if we're able to fill a position. So in that sense, it's like a pretty low risk proposition to start working with us, see if we can increase your fill rates and make schools just be operating better.
Mm-hmm.
Before I started SWING, I worked at a charter school that ran at the time 10 schools in San Jose, and I worked out of school buildings a lot. And I can tell you that when there just aren't enough adults in a building, it just feels so chaotic. It's something you really feel viscerally when you're working inside a school building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like the inmates running the asylum. You know? You don't want to have
kids.
Them. Exactly.
Yeah.
Running the whole thing. So you charge what to a school district? Because again, I guess you are in a catbird seat in a certain way because they're so desperate.
Yeah, I mean, we're not trying to take advantage of anybody. I think what we're trying to do is basically provide a service that school districts find valuable. So the way we work is that school districts set the pay that they want the substitute teachers to make. And then we charge a service fee on top of that that covers, you know, our W-2 costs for that substitute teacher, handling the payroll, managing them, all the costs that it took us to recruit them onto our platform and whatnot. So I think it's pretty fair. And again, it only gets charged if we're able to fill a role.
So you operate in California and New York, but also in Texas. And you mentioned that some teachers are reluctant to go into a classroom if the kids aren't vaccinated. Texas has banned businesses from implementing vaccine mandates. So how has it been trying to place teachers in Texas classrooms?
It's been interesting just throughout COVID, and it's constantly changing, as yourself and all of your listeners probably have felt. And it's just a lot of adjustments. I think what's been interesting is that the areas, like I'm up here in Santa Clara County and, you know, in the Bay Area, which is a highly vaccinated, call it COVID risk averse area. LA is similar. I think you have more of the concern of teachers not wanting to go into classrooms with unvaccinated students. I think you have a little bit less of that in areas like Texas, actually. Like, they're a little bit more risk tolerant of COVID. And so you have some less pushback. And so it sort of goes hand in hand, although it does make it more challenging if you yourself as a substitute just don't want to be in a riskier environment, for sure.
You know, the image of a substitute teacher is of someone who's just sitting in the front, you know, maybe puts a movie on and that's it. Doesn't know the name of the kids.
Rolls out the VCR.
Yeah.
In my day.
Right. Exactly.
The TV cart.
Is that what still happens?
I probably would say sometimes it probably is similar, you know, maybe a DVD player or streaming. But I think more and more now there's better ways to get that substitute teacher access to the curriculum that the kids are already working on. And that's largely due to technology. I mean, we did actually during the last couple of school years or the last school year and a half, call it, some virtual substitute teaching positions, and different things are possible now. And it doesn't always have to be a movie. We try and have our substitute teachers be prepared with lesson plans that they can do fairly generically across a couple of grade levels and subject areas. And that way, if they're not left with pretty comprehensive lesson plans, there are things that they can fall back on.
Is there an area, a discipline that is in most need of substitute teachers, like math or English or anything like that?
I think right now it covers the whole spectrum. I think mm-hmm. there are always higher needs because there's even a smaller pool when it comes to higher grade levels as math and science, foreign language, and special ed. Those will always be, I think, in particularly high demand and low supply.
Well, Mike, thank you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
My pleasure. That's Mike Tang, CEO of Swing Education. That's a Bay Area company that helps staff schools with substitute teachers. Coming up, the political controversy swirling around Jeopardy. That's coming up next on Press Play.
This is Jeopardy.
Okay, well, actually, this is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. But the long-running TV quiz show that rarely generates buzz has been in the spotlight a lot more than usual lately. Beloved longtime host Alex Trebek's death last year set off a search for his successor, but the person ultimately picked for the job resigned after just a single day of filming when previous sexist and anti-Semitic remarks he'd made resurfaced. Jeopardy now settled on actress Mayim Bialik as the host. She wants the job permanently, but she comes with her own controversies. Joining us to talk about all this upheaval on the normally staid Jeopardy is Julia Jacobs, culture writer for the New York Times. Julia, hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, so much drama for this show that's usually blessedly boring. So remind us how we got here with this Mike Richards problem and then this hurried naming of Mayim Bialik as the temporary host. What happened?
Well, it all started about a year ago, at the beginning of November, when Alex Trebek died after hosting the show for more than 36 years. It was a complete shock. And the producers of the show decided that the best course of action was not to name a new successor right away, but to spend a few months sort of trying out guest hosts. And Mayim Bialik was one of those hosts. So was Mike Richards. Now, when the decision came down in August that Mike Richards was going to be the permanent pick, I mean, no one guess that was going to happen. A lot of people were speculating about LeVar Burton, Ken Jennings. Mike Richards was really on no one's radar. And then about a week after he was chosen, we have this report from The Ringer digging up some of his comments from a podcast he hosted when he was executive producer of The Price is Right. You know, he's hosting only a day and then he steps down from that role. He stays executive producer, but then shortly after, you have him stepping down from that role too, as well as executive producer of The Wheel of Fortune. And so then you have Mayim Bialik stepping in, you have Ken Jennings stepping in for a bit at the end of the year. So it's all been a whirlwind. And I think the show is hoping to just weather the storm and, you know, by the end of the year, perhaps announce the actual permanent pick this time.
Mm. Well, meanwhile, I guess the show is lucky that it's had this super champion playing for a while, this guy named Matt Amodio. And he's from Connecticut. He's a grad student, and he won 38 straight games. So has that taken the spotlight away from this host drama for a little bit?
I would not be surprised if the producers there were heaving a sigh of relief at this amazing streak. You know, you have the second highest streak in the history of the game show.
And we have to say goodbye to Matt Amodio with an unbelievable 38-day winning streak. That is one for the books. It has been an honor and a pleasure to watch you here. Congratulations.
This guy has been on the show since July, and he recently lost, so that period of relief is now over. And the next question is, you know, is there going to be more drama in store for the show, or is everything going to sort of settle into a pattern until, you know, the final big announcement of the new host?
What happened to LeVar Burton?
LeVar Burton has long made clear that he sees this as the job of a lifetime. He sees this as something he's been working toward for his entire life. And he was getting a lot of support on social media. Now, it's important to note that the people talking about Jeopardy on social media are not exactly the same population who is watching Jeopardy every day. It's unclear if all the support was for LeVar, but he guest hosted and then recently came out and said, you know what, I don't really want this job anymore. After all the upheaval, after all the drama, he decided to, you know, kind of pull himself out of the running in a sense.
All right, so let's talk more about Mayim Bialik. She was also named originally as someone who would be hosting the primetime specials while Richards was the permanent host. Now she is the permanent interim host, so I guess she's doing it full time for a little bit until a permanent host is named. She wants the job. What's wrong with her being the permanent host? What are some of the issues that have been raised?
You know, these are things that people have been talking about on social media from as soon as her name came up as, you know, being the host of the primetime specials. As she told me in an interview, you know, she's been talking for a long time, and she has not been someone who's shied away from talking about controversial issues. She is someone who has a PhD in neuroscience, so she's seen as a real academic type figure. But, you know, in 2012, she wrote in her book about parenting that she and her husband at the time had made a choice not to vaccinate their two sons. There have been headlines saying that she's anti-vaccine, which she has rejected that label. Now she says she has gotten the COVID-19 vaccine, her sons have gotten the COVID-19 vaccine, but, you know, she still takes issues with vaccines in general, how many vaccines are given to children these days. So there's that. There's the fact that she has some pretty strong opinions on Israel. She calls herself a liberal Zionist. She once blogged about, you know, donating money toward bulletproof vests for the Israel Defense Forces during a war in 2014. And she also has endorsed this brain health supplement that has gotten into some legal trouble recently. It has agreed to settle a class action lawsuit that accused it of false advertising. And this lawsuit had already been filed at the time that she signed on to this campaign. Those are the three main pillars of controversy.
Well, does it really matter what her stances are on these issues? Because this is not a political position. It's not a journalism position. She's just a TV host of a game show.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of people think that, you know, who cares? Who cares what she thinks about vaccines or what she thinks about Israel? You know, we had a lot of comments on our story or our profile on her, and a good number of comments were about, you know, the fact that people don't care what the political beliefs of a game show host. You know, Pat Sajak on Wheel of Fortune is, you know, a proud Republican, and no one's ever really made a big deal about that. I mean, the thing that Mayim Bialik is up against is that Alex Trebek was really a pillar of nonpartisanship. He wrote in his memoir that he would get letters from Republicans thinking that he was a Republican, and he would get letters from Democrats thinking that he was a Democrat. So whoever is going to be the new host is going to be up against the expectations, you know, set by Alex Trebek. And so I think that's why people are taking such issue with her past stances. You know, at the same time, we just live in a world where when someone is getting a big job like this, people are going to pour through their past. People are going to pour through their tweets and comments and vlogs. And the fact is, she has a whole lot of them.
Hmm. Well, is there anyone else in serious consideration? Someone like Ken Jennings, for example?
Yeah, I think Ken Jennings has long been under consideration. I think he was considered the favorite, you know, in the immediate aftermath of Alex Trebek's death. But the fact is, you know, if Jeopardy was set on naming him as host, they would have done it already. So for some reason, you know, he has not been a favorite, at least, you know, when the first decision came for the initial choice. But clearly, you know, he's in the running. I mean, he is helping to host Jeopardy until the end of the year. You know, Ken Jennings is also a consulting producer of the show. He's actively involved in the show right now. So Mayim and Ken are definitely in the running, but who knows? It could be someone that no one's talking about right now.
When are they going to make an announcement?
Very unclear. You know, right now they say that Ken and Mayim will host until the end of the year as their schedules allow. And, you know, possibly we'll get an announcement in early 2022, but I think they're trying to sort of calm everything down, reduce the drama level, reduce the temperature, and, you know, let Jeopardy find, you know, a comfortable pattern before shaking everything up again.
It's just the idea of Jeopardy being shaken up yet again. It's almost too much to bear.
But it has to happen, you know, because you can't have an interim host forever.
Right. Well, why are we even talking about this? What is so important about Jeopardy in the first place?
You know, a lot of people just watch it every weekday, Monday through Friday. It's part of their routine, and it's a source of comfort. And Alex was a big part of that source of comfort. I think Jeopardy, the show itself, was able to have sort of a nonpartisan reputation so that it was, you know, accessible to people of all different political beliefs. And it's just an institution in our country. And like every institution, there are people who want it to stay exactly the same. But the reality is we've lost our host of 36 years, so it can't possibly stay the same.
No. I guess it's like an island in a sea of partisanship in our country. It's the only place, or one of the only places, where all sides can hang out and not fight. But maybe that's too good to be true, too, given what's happened recently.
I think it is too good to be true. I don't think anything is immune to politics in 2021.
Julia Jacobs from the New York Times, thank you.
Thank you.
What is the end of the show? Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great rest of your day. I will see you tomorrow.